Maduro's example, previous to that, Bashar Assad's example, previous to that, the leaders of Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. Collectively, the Iranian regime today is at its most vulnerable point in 47 years. The 12-day war demonstrated to the Iranian people that the emperor has no clothes. I believe that there is absolutely no question that invariably and inevitably, whatever and whomever replaces this regime, the future of Iran, if, and that's an important if it is reflective of the will and aspiration of the people of Iran, it will have no choice but to have fraternal relationships with everyone within the region, including Israel.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host, executive director of the Misgav Institute for National Security and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's national defense and resilience, its regional integration, and its international alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise to bring you fresh insights into the most important issues on the Israeli and Middle East national security agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And keep sending your comments. We read them and we appreciate them. This week, we have a very special guest who's going to give us deep insight behind the scenes into what's really happening in Iran and what the future for Iran and for Iran-Israel relations might look like. But before we get to our guest this week, Blav, this is our first recording in 2026. And I think it's a good opportunity to take a step back and look at where we are now on January 1st, 2026, or at the beginning of 2026, compared to where we were a little over 2 years ago on October 7th. And that was perhaps Israel's lowest point. And there were those who, at that point and during the ensuing war, thought that Israel was frankly near collapse. Israel was isolated. The Jewish state was in deep, deep trouble. And there are certainly many, many challenges that facing the state of Israel. That's what the Misgav Institute is meant to do, is meant to find solutions to those challenges. But I do think we should take a step back if we look at the macroeconomic indicators. Israel's nominal GDP per capita is this year $64,000 per person. That is in the top 20 in the world, higher than the UK, France, Germany. In fact, the OECD projects Israel's growth over the next 2 years to be 4.9 in 2026, 4.6 in 2027. Compared to the European Union, we're looking at 1.2, 1.4% over the next 2 years. Israel continues to rank, even after October 7th, even after 2 years of war, in the top 10 in the world happiness rankings. I think we were number 8 in the latest rankings. NVIDIA is going to open up one of its largest R&D centers here in Israel. Israel is going to become a world capital of AI research over the coming years. And certainly also, if you look in the security realm, yes, again, as we're going to talk about, Israel is facing severe, urgent military, security, and diplomatic challenges, quite frankly. But if you look at all the arenas again around us, whether it's Gaza, whether it's Iran, whether it's Lebanon, Israel's enemies are weaker than ever before. Israel is in a better position than ever before. What will be the future of the U.S.-Israel alliance? We don't know, and we'll continue to talk about that. But certainly we saw from Netanyahu's last visit in Florida in his meeting with President Trump, right now the relations between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump, between the U.S. and Israel, are strong, deep. There's coordination. I think we have to just take a moment and say, look at where we've been and look at where we are today. And I think that bodes very well for Israel's future.
I'm going to be the party pooper. First of all, I should say, I am broadly optimistic about Israel's future. And I think that the happiness index is a good indicator at least for Israel and the way, you know, anecdotally Israelis I know, but also you could see polls internally in Israel. Israelis tend to be optimistic. They tend to be happy. I think that a lot of the happiness is attributed to having very strong family connections and very strong communities in Israel. I think that these are important things that a lot of Western societies are isolated from or have weakened in Western societies and remain strong in Israel. I think that's super important. On the economic stuff, because I write for a foreign audience and I see what a lot of that kind of media is like, I realize like people who look at Israel from the outside see one picture and then the everyday person who lives here sees another picture, right? So like the GDP is really high compared to a lot of other countries. But on the other hand, the prices here are outrageous, like super, super high. And, you know, the high tech industry is booming, but it's a pretty small minority of the population, right? And then the frankly unproductive sectors of the population are growing. They tend to be the sectors that have the most children, which is to say more than 50% of Haredi adults don't work, right? It's about half of men and about 20% of women, which, by the way, the women percentage of Haredi women who work is about the same as the percentage of the broader population. But the men, half of them are not working, or at least not working on the books. And in Arab society, I don't know the exact statistics, but the rate of women who work is very low. And these are populations that are growing. So on the one hand, you have the high tech, which is the engine of the Israeli economy. And on the other hand, you have people who, you know, please God, there be some kind of change and they'll all get those kinds of jobs. But the way things are going now, there's something has to change in order for this great economic miracle to continue. It seems that that's, you know, we have an election year in 2026. That's one of the things you didn't mention in your overview.
It's a positive sign or a negative sign? And Israel's
we
like
always
elections.
Have elections, so I'm just going to say it's neutral. But I think something that is positive about this election, and, you know, whatever, it's subjective, but this is my view, is that people want a real change when it comes to encouraging the less productive sectors of society to be more productive. I mean, that seems like it's going to be a leading election issue. And it's been a political issue for a long time, certainly the entire time I've been reporting on politics, which is since 2011. But I would say as a serious political issue, it started in 1999 with some breaks. I think that this might be the time that it really makes a difference, because I think a lot of times you hear a lot of talk about it sort of on the news and from politicians, and then in the end, voters don't vote on it. I could be wrong, but looking at polling and just talking to people, I have a feeling that this is going to be the issue in the coming year.
And I think you're absolutely right about there are worrying trends, exactly the ones that you mentioned. And we definitely can't rest on our laurels, and the decisions and the strategies that we developed today are going to be what's going to impact us 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. I think in my view, in my subjective sense, and you know, this is not objectively proven, but for many Israelis, particularly from the productive sectors, let's call that, are coming back after, they're still doing reserve duty, obviously, but that's also decreasing by a degree. And after almost 2.5 years of active high-intensity war, there is a desire for a real change, and a sense that while we still are divided, what unifies us is still greater than what divides us. A sense of, again, not everybody, but among many people, of national purpose and national pride. And I think also pent up creative energy, you know, to take, you know, to go from the high intensity experience of conflict over the last 2.5 years, which might not be over, but seems to be subsiding, and use that to be creative, to create new things, new sectors, new developments. I don't know. Maybe I'm overly optimistic.
No, well, I think that is part of the reason there may be a political change, right? It's what we're seeing sort of murmurs of in the field, that people who were involved in this war in different ways now want to get involved in the politics of the country. I don't want to say necessarily it's younger people. Like, frankly, we've had millennials in the Knesset for like 10, going on 10 years now, more than 10 years.
With mixed results.
With mixed results, exactly.
To put it generously.
You know what? There's some people who, like, I don't necessarily agree with their political ideas, but I think are very serious people. And then there's some people whose political ideas I agree with almost entirely, and they're unserious people. So you really never know. But that's in terms of the millennials. I do see a lot of energy coming from former reservists, to some extent, wives of reservists. So I think it'll be an interesting year to watch. Even though I will say, you know, Likud and Netanyahu are polling pretty well. So maybe it won't be the year of change. And change also doesn't mean from right to left, right? I think that even before the war, Israelis were pretty right-wing in their political views in terms of what Israeli right-wing means, which basically means hawkish and not wanting to give up territory to the Palestinians. I think that Israelis have moved even more to the right since October 7th, and that means that the parties that were once called centrist have moved to the right in their positions as well.
So apropos Netanyahu, and going back to the challenges that we're facing, there's a lot of speculation now about Iran and potential Israeli action on Iran. Obviously, the capture, the arrest of Maduro and President Trump's threats to the Iranian regime also are leading to a lot of speculation. Lav, what do you think that we're seeing?
The first thing we have to say is we don't really know if Maduro's regime has really fallen. I know it's crazy because we see Maduro, you know, is in jail in New York, his vice president is in charge now. You know, like nobody else has been replaced. The Trump administration does not seem to trust the actual winners of the election last year in Venezuela, which is interesting because, you know, Trump likes to believe that his election was stolen. And then when there's an election that was truly stolen last year, he's not going to respect the result. But at the moment, the person in charge is Maduro's deputy, and she has long shared Maduro's ideology. She's like a real party ideologue. Whether American sort of supervision of what they're doing is going to be enough remains really unclear. That being said, I would think that American supervision would be enough to weaken Iran's hold in Venezuela. And Iran is involved at a lot of levels in Venezuela. They have arms manufacturing there. They have Venezuelans making Iranian designed drones. Maduro was buying gasoline from Iran in exchange for gold, which is insane because Venezuela has such huge, I think they have the largest oil deposits in the world. And yet they had to buy from Iran because their oil industry was such a basket case that they didn't have gasoline of their own. And basically, Venezuela is also Iran's base. Like, it's sort of jumping off point for all of its operations in Latin America, including just a couple months ago, an attempted assassination of Israel's ambassador to Mexico. So I think, even though I do have concerns about, like, the freedom of the Venezuelan people and, like, what kind of government's going to come up there, at the very least, this is going to weaken Iran. So that's a good thing.
And that's a great segue to our guest this week. This week's guest is Mehrdad Mardi Yosefiani, an Iranian-American strategic communications expert. Born in Tehran, he spent 35 years leading high-stakes global political and corporate initiatives and served for nearly two decades as the chief strategic counselor to Iran's crown prince, Reza Pahlavi. Today as well, Mardi continues to communicate and work closely with many of the key players in Iran, among those opposed to the regime, among the Iranian diaspora, and with decision makers in the United States and across the Middle East. Mardi takes us behind the scenes and in depth into what's really happening in Iran right now, the path forward to a better day after, and what American and Israeli leaders should and should not do at this critical and sensitive moment. So without further ado, stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Mardi Yosefiani. Mehrdad Mardi Yosefiani, it really is an honor to have you on the podcast this week. When we see, I don't know, quote, unprecedented, but widespread turmoil, turbulence in Iran, the many parts of the Iranian people who are rising up, first prep for economic issues, but now explicitly calling for a new government, for the downfall of the current regime. Why don't you start give us a little bit of your personal background, your personal story, your connection with the Iranian crown prince, and then a little bit, you know, we're all watching the news reports, but from what you're seeing from the inside, from your communications and your close ties with people in Iran on the ground, what is happening in Iran right now?
Yeah, well, for the most part, as you can appreciate, the vast majority of the Iranian diaspora, which numbers in excess of 4.5 to 5 million worldwide, are all tuned in 24/7 with what's going on at the homeland. Many of us still have a close family and friends who live in Iran. Some of them travel back and forth, some of them don't. But as you appreciate, Iranians are very, very much tied in to the homeland, and irrespective of how many years we may have been spending in exile, we begin and frequently end the day, especially these days, thinking and looking at what's happening back home. So we're all glued and we're all following. And if we have 5 million in exile diaspora, we probably have 5 million different perspectives and reads on what's happening. But universally, we are all hopeful. We're all hopeful that this yet again, another wave of protests may be taking at the bottom of the pillar, and hopefully imposing deeper and deeper cracks, whereby soon the regime will fall on its own weight.
Just a little bit about your background with your family and also your close relationship with the Crown Prince.
I left Iran like many of my peers in the late 70s for education, boarding schools and then university, first in Europe and then in the United States. And then the revolution happened. And like many like us, we were caught, cut off. And back then, of course, you recall, well, you don't, you're too young to recall, but we did not have phones and texts and not even fax machines at the time. So we were literally cut off for weeks and months when the revolution was taking place. So I am from that generation whose parents belong to the former regime, having worked in my case in the government and in many other cases in the private sector. But the revolution took place and we have been sort of left outside. Yes, you mentioned my relations with the Crown Prince, Reza Pahlavi. I did for a period of, I would say, maybe a little under 2 decades, serve in the capacity of chief, strategic communications counselor to him. My personal background has been campaign management, election campaigns, from presidential campaigns in the U.S., senatorial and so forth, and internationally, and corporate communication. So that's my background, and I've sought to employ it to the benefit of my homeland when the time calls for it.
Can you tell us a little bit about what is unique about the protests that are going on now? People seem very hopeful that this time it might actually work.
Yeah, well, as you said, why is it different? Fundamentally, because the world always remembers the last round, and the last round, if you recall, was the Mahsa Amini sort of revolution or protest, which people like me call the first women's revolution the world has seen, which continues. The spirit of that, and generally speaking, the spirit of the quest for liberty and freedom, is the common thread that weaves through all of the various waves that we have had. Revolutions are continuous. Revolutions come in waves. And this is yet another wave of that same revolution, fundamentally, again, for liberty, freedom, opportunity. What is distinct this time around is the economic fundamentals that have driven the people into the streets. The fall of the rial, the national currency, its effect and collapse on commerce, the economic collapse, which the president Pezeshkian every single day goes on television and admits to and reminds people that he has no solutions for. He has no not a dollar in the state treasury to address, and is incapable of helping. Every single day he reminds the Iranian people of that. Add to that the environmental catastrophe, add to that the absence of water, add to that lack of civil rights and human rights and women rights. All of that is culminated in what actually broke about a week ago, where members of the bazaar could no longer handle the economic pressures, and that triggered this last round. So the difference here is this last round is economic, it's commercial, and that alone, I believe, gives people even more confidence and sort of courage, if you will, to come out in the streets. Because if you're protesting for bread, if you're protesting for water, if you're protesting for a right to have a job, that it does not require as much courage as if you're protesting for ideological reasons or political reasons. So this is the difference now, that we have people that are quite courageous. And what another element that's different is that this round, I believe the protests have sort of include an enormous broad spectrum of all members, all strata of society, from the poor to the young, to the old, to the bazaaris or the commercial people, to regime reformist types. All sorts have joined in because, again, fundamentally it's economic and it's not a political threat to the individual. They're asking for what they believe is their right.
At what point, or what are the signs that would indicate that the regime is indeed becoming unstable? I mean, obviously, according to various reports, if Khamenei, you know, gets up and runs away to Moscow, that's a clear indication. But what are signs that we might see, either in terms of the courageous demonstrators, in terms of his expansion to more areas or more parts of the population, or in terms of initial signs by the regime or by the president or by lawmakers or by law enforcement? What are signs that we might be heading towards a real fundamental change in the very nature of Iran?
I'm not sure if I grasp exactly what you mean by that question. Fundamental change in terms of the dynamics.
To the government, in terms of the government.
This government is unlike the previous government of the Shah, which basically was committed to avoid a spilling of blood. Unlike the Shah himself, who chose to leave, as opposed to, quoting his own words, keep his crown held up by the blood of people, this regime will not hesitate. It will use brute force. It has exercised that many times before. Internationally, it has exercised that. Let's not forget, it was the Iranian regime that held up the Bashar Assad regime for many, many years by literally slaughtering hundreds of thousands of Syrians right next door to Israel. You Israeli population, I'm sure, was quite privy and observing that. It was the Iranian regime. So they have experience in exercising such brute force. And that's the difference, that this regime will not, and until the last moment, will fight, if you will, sadly, to the death. However, again, going back to what's different this time around, is that when things are economically based, the Basij, which is the force tasked with clubbing and suppressing the streets, the IRGC, the Sepah, if you will, the law enforcement of the regime, they also suffer. It is their children, it is their brothers and sisters and parents who don't have money. It is their brothers and sisters and parents and children who, when they go to the faucet, open it and there's no water coming out. It's universal. And so when they're asked to club and shoot and contain and control and slaughter, frequently we see that the start of the crack comes when there is reluctance. So those are the first indicators. And to mitigate that, we have already seen various videos and visuals of cars driving with foreign license plates, whether it be Afghanistan or Iraq or Turkey or Syria or where not, any of our regional neighbors, where men get out of those cars speaking in frequently Arabic, clearly the type of people the regime would import to sort of mitigate any defection and reluctance by their law enforcement. So those are also signs. The regime will hold out, and if we use American football analogy, this is probably mid fourth quarter as opposed to the end of fourth quarter, 2 minutes warning.
What do you think needs to happen for the protests to successfully bring down the regime?
We are careful. We need to be careful for, those like myself in the comfort and security of exile to sit down and prescribe, people to go out in the streets and sacrifice and endanger their lives. But ultimately, like all revolutions, it is the calibrated moment where the masses combine with broad geographic footprint. That combination typically exhausts regimes, whereby they cannot contain and control the size nor the geographic spread of protests. So ultimately, without advocating or putting anyone in danger, ultimately that is what will determine the final outcome. But it remains to be seen, and we are quite very worried because as we speak now, I think in excess of 20 people have been killed, nearly 100 have been injured, hundreds have been detained and arrested, and mind you, this is coming with a backdrop of more than 2,000 Iranians that have been executed at the hands of the Iranian regime this past year alone. And the Persian New Year is still, our New Year falls 21st of March. So we worry. We worry the cost of life. Of our youth, of our brothers and sisters and parents. But unfortunately, this is the price the regime is forcing our countrymen to pay.
What impact, if any, do you think the 12-day war had on creating the conditions for this uprising, for these demonstrations, whether in terms of its economic impact or in terms of its impact in exposing the weakness of the regime, the promises? You know, I think in a lot of Iranian media, you have the sort of boasting that Israel was not able to harm Iran at all, and that Iran dealt a massive blow, and Tel Aviv has been destroyed, and all these kinds of ridiculous claims. But my sense is that at least many parts of the Iranian people have a much better sense of how Israel was able to relatively quickly achieve total air superiority over Iran. So what impact did that have on the way people view the regime and obviously the sanctions, which are obviously impacting the economic situation? That's my first question. And my second question is, what impact do you think that President Trump's threats on social media, again today on a press conference on Air Force One, are having on the regime's response to the protesters? Do you think that they're leading the regime to try to restrain itself or to make its repression less overt?
The 12-day war, very simply, it demonstrated to the Iranian people that the emperor has no clothes. Despite the regime's huff and puff and posturing, global and regional, especially coming at the heel of the collapse of Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, and the collapse of Bashar Assad, this was the fourth leg. The Iranian regime, as you said, was unable, within hours of the attack, lost its aerial control. I believe to date, Israel can exercise command and control of the Iranian airspace. So that was one glaring element. Now, having said that, it's critical to add that as an Iranian, irrespective of our cultural and civilizational sympathy, goodwill, relations and alliance with the Jewish people and the Jewish civilization, it's biblical, as you know, that notwithstanding, no Iranian can express joy and happiness when the homeland is bombed. So it's a dual emotional response. On one front, yes, it is the occupying regime that brought this on to the homeland. I believe the punitive measures that were exercised against some of the elements that have been key in suppressing the Iranian people or squandering or looting our national wealth was welcoming. But at the same time, somebody like me, even sitting in exile, was concerned about what is happening to my compatriots where bombs are falling over the head. So you must appreciate, just like an Israeli would never accept bombs falling over their head, irrespective of their position and viewpoint on and support for or against the government. The Iranian regime also was able to take advantage of that dual sentiment, and at least for a short window, it was able to at least freeze and ice any pro-war sentiments or punitive aerial attack sentiments in favor of the territorial integrity of the homeland. But it was short-lived. It is short-lived. There is no love lost. There is no love gained for the Iranian regime. And it knows that. It knows that. Its weakness was exposed. And that, I believe, is part of the sort of, if you will, the confidence that may be at play right now, motivating the Iranian people to inject energy in the streets.
So we're talking just a few days after the U.S. captured Venezuela's illegitimate president, Maduro. I was wondering what kind of impact do you think that's having on the situation in Iran? Like whether Iran...
Significant.
Yeah.
Enormous. Very, very powerful. The optics are undeniably worrisome for the regime. Especially it coming at the eve of President Trump, Secretary of State Rubio, who wears a dual hat as National Security Advisor to the President, and others, including the British and others, conveying to the Iranian regime and private messages being exchanged and warnings being sent. Don't forget, the Deputy Foreign Minister of the Iranian regime shared that prior to the war, the 12-day war imposed by Israel, Tehran was warned, was given the option of coming to the table, and of course it refused, and thus the attack was exercised against Iran. Now, coming with that experience in hand, and having heard sort of messages, strong, serious messages coming from Washington or Mar-a-Lago, if you will, or Air Force One, the Iranian regime is taking things very seriously. The American capacity to fly in and grab Maduro with precision, without losing a single asset overnight, was powerful, especially that we saw and the world was shown the precision of intelligence and military execution before and after the 12-day war So it is very seriously being looked at by Tehran. I believe if I were to be a fly on Khamenei's wall, I don't think his tummy is doing too well these days. He must be rolling with a lot of worry, as well as his generals, who, frankly, were rendered incapable of doing anything. If the 12 days showed anything, they were all out to lunch or dinner or sleeping, if you will. So it's serious. Maduro's example, previous to that, Bashar Assad's example, previous to that, the leaders of Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, collectively, the Iranian regime today is at its most vulnerable point in 47 years.
If you were sitting now with President Trump and or with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and you had to give them one piece of advice, what piece of advice would you give to each of those leaders, do's, don'ts, in light of what's happening on the street in Iran?
Well, if I were sitting with them and if I were a physician, I would reference to my oath, the Hippocratic Oath, which translates into, first and foremost, bring no harm. Do no harm to the patient. I believe, though the sentiments are well placed and the Israeli people have demonstrated their support for the Iranian people in a sincere fashion, as has Prime Minister Netanyahu and previous prime ministers and leaders of Israel, always consistently expressed their sincerity towards the people of Iran. I believe, however, it is not helpful for members or political leaders closely associated with this current government or previous governments to repeatedly, over and over and openly, engage as if they are running and commanding and controlling the streets of Iran. This is an Iranian political enterprise. This is an Iranian national will being exercised, and no foreign nation, neither Israel nor America nor any European or regional government, should play it as if they are commanding and controlling the streets. It is the Iranian people who are commanding and controlling it. And for the regime to be given the excuse, as Khamenei just did 24 hours ago, attributing the Iranian street demonstrations to foreign elements, specifically Israel and the United States, is not helpful. We have very well-meaning members of the Israeli cabinet who are every single day, if not every other day, tweeting, messaging, endorsing specific ideologies, telling and promising every single day that next year in Tehran. We appreciate that. We know and understand what that in spirit means, but it's not helpful to the Iranian people. So if I were to sit with our dear friends, Israeli cabinet members and the prime minister and so forth, I would say just continue being supportive, continue being appreciative of the Iranian people and the civilizational ties that we have, but stay away from telling the Iranian people to pour into the streets and do the job. Believe me, they know what they need to do. It's not helpful for non-Iranians to engage and tell them. And this comes from somebody that obviously has complete respect and affection for our allies around the world.
Who are some of the key players in this movement that you can tell us about? I mean, I think our listeners are probably pretty familiar with the Shah's son, with the prince, but you can also tell us a little about him. But people also who are inside Iran maybe are the leaders of the various groups that are involved in this protest.
Yeah. The most important players in this enterprise, in this political undertaking, is no other than the Iranian people. Now, the Iranian nation of 90 million plus is not a monolith. We have amongst us a diverse group of ideologies that people are passionate for. Yes, there is no doubt that my former principal, Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, the Pahlavi brand has a presence in Iran. There's no denying that. But I will, and I think he himself will also be the first to tell you that it is, while a serious presence, it is not enough. It is not a super overwhelming majority to run the entire country. There may be just as many as Pahlavi supporters, royalist monarchy supporters, if some numbers have referenced maybe 30-35% support in Iran, at least that amount represents those who would label themselves as Republican in terms of those who favor a republic. And then, of course, you have perhaps at least or at most 10% of the population who are stalwart supporters of the regime. And then you have, like any society, a percentage of people who really are not sure what they want in terms of ideology. So what I'm trying to say is that the Iranian people, not being a monolith, its solution lies in a pluralistic approach, a coalition of various ideologies and political forces, from royalists and constitutional monarchists to those who desire republic, those who may have been formerly members of the reformists of the regime, those who may have formerly been stalwart supporters, members of the Sepah or Basij forces of the regime. All of these forces who are starting to come together, I think a coalition of some sort will be the only way the day after in Iran can really engage and respond. No single group or ideology can bully its way or dictate the terms of the day after, in my view.
So talking about the day after, and first of all, I just want to say, obviously I can understand how the Iranian people, in the, no matter whether or not they support the regime, how they feel when they see the planes of a foreign country in their airspace dropping bombs. So I can certainly identify with what you said. Obviously, Israel needed to do what it needed to do in order to face those strategic threats. But from the perspective of the Israeli people, you know, it's not just the ministers. I think the Israeli people only have warm feelings and goodwill towards the Iranian people, Persian culture, Persian, from the Persian Jewish community that plays a very, very important part in Israel's public and national life and culture. I think that the Israeli people truly would like nothing more than to once again have warm, open, friendly relations with the people of Iran. Looking ahead, let's say the regime does fall in the next week, month, year. As you pointed out, there are different people with different ideologies. What happens next? What's the path forward to creating a brighter day after for Iran, for the people of Iran?
Be omid khoda, inshallah, or as you say, be ezrat Hashem, if that day comes soon. We all look forward and aspire to that. I believe that there is absolutely no question that invariably and inevitably, whatever and whomever replaces this regime, the future of Iran, if, and that's an important if it is reflective of the will and aspiration of the people of Iran, it will have no choice but to have fraternal relationships with everyone within the region, including Israel. It will have no choice but to open its borders and welcome what is tradition to Persian culture, that is open commerce and trade. That is a fundamentally Persian thing. We've all heard about the Persian bazaar. That is the origination of the marketplace. So Iranians will desire open borders, open trade with the West, of course, with East, with North and South. And I think if a government represents the will of the people, it will be that. And I think it'll be a moment where the regime, the region will actually have a sigh of relief, that it will be a consequential turning point in the history of that part of the world, in fact, globally affecting many, many, many other fronts. So, yes, I am very, very hopeful that it will be positive, but providing, again, as long as it represents the will of the people.
On that optimistic note, I think we're going to wrap up. Thank you so much, Marty, for being here with us and teaching us a lot about what's happening in Iran. And we'd love to have you back sometime.
Thank you, Lahav. Thank you, Aisher. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to like and subscribe to the podcast and share it with others who may find it valuable. You can follow the Miskav Institute for National Security at www.miskavins.org. And you can send us your questions, your comments, your suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.